Hi everyone, this is Kina Wolfenstein and you're listening to the Complex Trauma Recovery Podcast. Today I have an interview to share, but before I introduce the guest, just a few show announcements. So below in the podcast description, you will find my link tree. In my link tree, you'll find all the different resources that I have. My Patreon is there where you can access bonus content and help support the work that I do. The workshops that I have done and are available are listed there. And then I also do have a workshop coming up on March 10th, all about attachment trauma. And the information for how to register for that is also in the link tree. So feel free to check that out. And that's my dog barking. Quartz, it's fine. That's the joys of living in an apartment with a dog. Okay, so today my guest is Amy Myers, and we are talking about sibling abuse. So I am putting like a, you know, loose kind of trigger warning on this episode. We don't talk about anything in, you know, particularly graphic terms, but we are talking about sibling abuse. And so I, you know, imagine that that could be triggering for some people. But it was also an extremely educational conversation. I learned a lot, and I think you guys will too. So Amy Myers, PhD and LCSW, is a social work professor at Molloy University and a clinician in New York City, where she has maintained a private practice for 30 years. She's an advisory board member to the Sibling Abuse and Aggression Research Advocacy Initiative at the University of New Hampshire and has published and presented nationally about sibling abuse. She has also conducted numerous trainings and workshops on diversity locally and nationally and transformed the Long Island School District's approach to culturally responsive and inclusive teaching. Dr. Myers is the host of a podcast titled What Would Dr. Myers Do? focused on counter-transference and getting into the mind of a therapist, where there is a dedicated series on the issue of sibling abuse. So I had a really good conversation with Amy, and we talked a lot about what sibling abuse is and what causes it and why it's not really talked about or understood or represented as much as it should be, considering how common it is. So enjoy the episode. Okay. Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Okay. So, to start off, could you just introduce yourself and the topic for our podcast today?
Sure. Hi. So my name is Amy Myers. I am a psychotherapist. I'm trained as a social worker and as a psychoanalyst, and I've been in practice for 30 years. I'm also a professor at Molloy University on Long Island, New York. And I would love to be able to share and spread awareness about sibling abuse. So thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you reached out and introduced the topic, I was excited because it's something that comes up a lot in my practice. Like I hear about sibling abuse frequently, and I find that most people that have experienced it feel really alone in it. Like people don't know how common it is, I found.
It's actually the most common form of family violence that was found in a study many moons ago. And yet I feel like it still kind of remains under the radar. So it's really curious to me. And this is where I always tend to flip the table. So I'm going to stay, keep me steady streamed, because okay. I would love to ask you, well, I don't hear a lot of therapists who say, or social workers who say that they see this in their practice. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, people don't know the questions to ask, so how to uncover it. And most people don't use the language, you know, when they're clients to say that they have been abused, because society hasn't really validated the experience through language, through literature. You know, you'll see sibling rivalry and aggression and violence and abuse all used interchangeably. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting to me that you have a practice full of people.
Yeah. Well, I would love to hear about kind of the different kinds of sibling violence that you've researched. But what I found in my practice is mostly like sibling sexual abuse. I have I've had a lot of clients that have been sexually abused by a sibling. And yeah, there's a whole other kind of like shame and stigma around it when it's a sibling. And then there's also the layer of like how the family reacts to it and kind of how the parents intervene or don't intervene. So a lot of clients, like it becomes really complex trauma because they have this abuse with the sibling and then the parents don't protect them, or the parents, you know, kind of protected the sibling that was being abusive. Or so it becomes a whole kind of complicated family dynamic.
Absolutely. I call that's called a double whammy, right? So not only are they experiencing abuse from their sibling, but the parent who neglected to respond, either because they're emotionally absent or physically absent or got their own stuff going on.
Yep. So I've seen that a lot for sure. And then I've had some incidents of like, sibling kind of just like physical and emotional violence too. But that one hasn't been as common. It's been mostly sexual abuse in my experience.
It's interesting. I don't know if it hasn't been as common or maybe not as common in your practice, because in general, that is the area of my focus is physical and emotional, because sexual is kind of usually more evident. And so that comes to people's attention, I think more so, but it doesn't mean that it's more prevalent as a whole than emotional and or physical.
That makes sense. Yeah, so can you speak a little bit to that? What about the physical and emotional side of it and what you've learned about there?
I embarked on a study, many years ago, and now I see people in my practice and dealing kind of with it head on as those who have lived through the experience. But when I did my study, I interviewed people who had lived through the experience as a children and or adolescents. And I think, what led me there is multiple experiences. One is my own experience in childhood and no, and during adolescence with sibling abuse. And when I was embarking on my dissertation, one of my professors called our research MeSearch, because it had to hold your attention for, at least 5 years that you were going to be working on this. And most people, want to learn more about things that they've gone through and spread awareness of that and then help others. And I always say that, like, as social workers, we go into this field kind of to heal ourselves, whether we're consciously aware of that or not. So that's kind of the thread. But then when I started actually doing the research, it was kind of shocking to me that I looked at the literature and, if you put in parent-child abuse, you'll get 4 to 5,000, or maybe 10,000 at this point, who knows, pieces of literature on that topic. Back then, when I started this, there were literally like five studies on sibling abuse, even though there was a huge one that uncovered it in 1990 by Vernon Wehe, and he really put it on the map. But then it just dropped off. So now, it's nice to see that there's probably a good 100 or so studies done on it, but it still remains under the radar. And kids are suffering, and adults, who have lived through this experience, because it has a strong impact on one's self-esteem, on one's interpersonal relationships. And I don't know how much you want to get into that, but one of the things that I'm trying to do is kind of establish it as a complex trauma.
Oh,
I mean, that's your
absolutely.
focus, right?
Yeah, I mean, how could it not be? Because I mean, with complex trauma, it's about trauma that is prolonged and enduring instead of just a one-time incident. And if it's your sibling, I mean, that's someone you're growing up with and spending a ton of time with, and likely that abuse is happening over the course of years, not just a one or two time incident, right?
Right. That so actually, I found that the average of the participants that were in my study endured it from ages 6 to about age 16, because usually there's a, I'm on average 2 year age gap. Could be more. It could be 7 year age gap. But around 16, the older sibling is leaving the home, either to go to college or just to get out there on their own. So that's, if you think about it, 12 years is the average duration to experience that. That's pretty traumatic. But as you said, what is complex trauma? Yes, it's prolonged, it's interpersonal, and it's deliberate. And it usually begins in childhood during developmentally vulnerable times. And it's imposed by a primary attachment figure. And so we usually kind of overlook the sibling as a primary attachment figure,
That's
but
a
they
really
are.
good point. Yeah, that's a really good point. When it comes to the kind of like attachment world, it's so much focus on caregivers. So I would love to hear you speak a little bit about the kind of attachment bond that forms between siblings and, what is unique about sibling attachments, or what is uniquely traumatic, I guess, when sibling attachments become abusive or dysfunctional.
Well, as you kind of referenced, siblings are our longest term relationship, unless one dies prematurely or there's an emotional cutoff. I mean, there'll be no other relationship that you have that's longer in your life. So it's pretty prominent. And then I think that there's the inherent nature of sibling relationships, where there's expectations of loyalty, of trust, of closeness that's just inherent in being in the same family, being close to somebody's age, or being a peer. But siblings shape our sense of loyalty, friendship, conflict, communication, There is so many important ways of relating that we learn through that sibling bond. So when that bond is disturbed, there's a lot that can go on that gets transmitted into our interpersonal relationships. And so I think that this is a good segue to kind of distinguish between sibling rivalry and sibling abuse, because sibling rivalry is a normative part of development. And it helps us do what I was kind of referencing, which is to develop skills of cooperation, negotiation, conflict resolution. So it's kind of healthy sometimes for parents to kind of stay back and let the children resolve it themselves. But that is when the discord between siblings is sporadic in terms of the power differential. So say you and I were siblings and we got into an argument, and this argument, I kind of have the power. I'm kind of pushing you around either emotionally or physically. And the next time we argue, you're doing it to me.
Right.
So we're changing dynamics. Sometimes it could happen in the same argument. You know, one moment you're have the power and the next moment I have the power. But in sibling abuse, one child consistently has the power, and the other child experiences a sense of hopelessness, a sense of helplessness, a pervasive sense of being hurt, either emotionally and or physically. And the intention by the offending sibling is to harm. Whereas in sibling rivalry, there's not necessarily an intention to hurt the sibling, right? They just don't necessarily know how to regulate their emotions or get what they need.
Or there's some competitiveness or antagonism, but it's not. Yeah. And as you're saying that, I'm imagining probably a lot of people that have dealt with sibling abuse, it was dismissed as sibling rivalry, right? Like, I bet that's
exactly right.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny that you're very astute to say that, because when I was beginning my research and even just telling my friends and colleagues that I was doing a study on sibling abuse, they would say, give me a break. Isn't it just normative sibling rivalry? I mean, every sibling fights and they're just being dramatic. And it's like,
no. Right off the gate.
And that's the problem. Yeah, right out of the gate. And that's the problem, is that we dismiss that person's experience, which is also very damaging.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Yeah, I'm curious. I feel like a question that a lot of people would have would be, what are the, you know, family dynamics that lead to sibling abuse? Like, does this only happen when parents are abusive, or is there some other kind of, you know, family issue that leads to this that research has found?
Yeah, so you can tell that you're a clinician. You're asking really good questions. So yes, there's a lot of risk factors. And so what I uncovered in my study is that, first of all, when there's parent-child abuse present, then it often leads to sibling abuse. One, because of displacement, right? The child who's being abused by the parent doesn't have the ability to fight back with the parent, so they take it out on their other sibling.
Right.
But aside from that, there's many aspects that are happening outside of the home and inside the home. So single parent families, more likely to have stress in the home, more likely to have limited resources. I always say you need to feed a parent in order for the parent to feed the child. It makes me think about, like, when we're on an airplane and they say put the oxygen on the parent first so that they can tend to their child. And there's so much truth in that in regard to, you know, our resources get depleted as parents. And so kids take a lot of attention and they have a lot of needs. And when the parent is stressed, that kind of filters in. So it could be from being a single parent, but not always. I mean, certainly in dual parent families, it could be when there's work stress, right? And then there's less attention to one has to be able to, and energy one has to be able to tend to the children. There are parents who put the children in the caregiving position. So that breeds a lot of resentment. Oftentimes it's the older sibling who then takes out their anger and hostility, and also doesn't have the tools to parent, right? They don't know how to discipline, but they're kind of put in the position of disciplining their younger sibling or their peer. It's not always the older child to the younger child, but it's the most common. Favoritism. One child being favored in the family and the other child being extremely resentful of that. Colluding. You know, sometimes I've had instances where people will tell me that their sibling is yelling at them and kind of using their power in a non-productive way. And the parent might say, you know, well, he might has important things to say. or does not protect the child from this. Parents who are unable to manage the aggressive sibling or abusive sibling. Parents who are physically absent or emotionally absent because they're just too stressed and they don't know what's going on. But I will say, not because I really don't want to blame parents, because I think most of the time, parents do the best they can. It might not be good enough, but they're doing the best they can. Mm-hmm. And so they need support. They need social capital. They need resources in the community to help them deal with what's happening, but also to see the harm that it's doing. Because I've had parents who have brought their targeted child to therapy. And of course, that's helpful, but it also identifies that child as the problem.
Right.
And usually, sibling abuse is a symptom of a, faulty family system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, I've talked a lot on here about parentification and how the trauma of being, a parentified eldest sibling, but I never thought about how then that could lead to secondary sibling abuse. Yeah. All of that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, I would like to see this get on the statutes of, I don't know what it's called in your county, but whether it's the Department of Social Services or Child Protection Services, to get on the statutes, because there is nothing there that protects children from sibling abuse unless it's sexual assault.
Right.
So this is really problematic. And then it was just brought to my attention that the CDC, the Child Development Center, actually stipulates that if this goes on within a family, it's okay. Right. So here we are tending to bullying and what's happening and how horrible. And we know the effects of that, from a peer. Why wouldn't that be just as caustic
in the home and with this?
In the home?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I had a really eye-opening moment once where I was talking to another therapist and we were talking about bullying, really, kind of severe bullying. And she said, I actually prefer to call it peer abuse. And I had never heard that term before. And I was like, wow, yeah, that really validates, the severity of it so much, because it can be, really, really impactful. And so, yeah, the language we use really matters. And the fact that you don't even hear people talk about sibling abuse very much, it's really, no wonder that it gets so kind of invisibilized in these conversations.
Right. And so that's interesting talking about language, because I'm also thinking about, I always use survivor and victim while it's happening in childhood or adolescence, and survivor that the adult has lived through this, and the abuser as the person. And I think, but, labels are dangerous, right? And abuser's really intense. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to move towards aggressor, mm-hmm. not to excuse the behavior, but to understand it, because I know that there's these memes all the time, right? Hurt people hurt people. Mm-hmm. And yes, that's true. So the person who's abusing or who's aggressing is going through something too. Not that it's okay what they're doing and how they're handling it, but I think we have to be a little bit more sensitized to that. And in terms of survivor, I will just speak from my own personal experience. That never really felt right. Victim didn't feel right either, because I don't know, maybe it's just not acceptable for myself in terms of seeing yourself, or you're, often called, oh, you're such a victim by the aggressor. So it just doesn't feel good to
totally.
See yourself as that as well. But, and even survivor means I endured and I conquered
I
somehow, right? And I didn't. I just lived through it, and thank God came out the other side with, some healthy coping skills due to a lot of therapy. But I think because there's maybe shame and stigma attached to it, one doesn't want to see themselves as a victim or a survivor. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm grappling with that.
Yeah, yeah. Are there other language alternatives that you found to describe that experience that do feel better?
Thanks for asking that. I'm thinking about target, right? Mm. The target, the aggressor, and the target.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, that feels very grounded in the kind of, it just is, it describes the dynamic instead of describing the people more so, right? So it's less of an identity and it's more of the dynamic of what's happening.
Right. And maybe it thinks, when I teach, it's funny, when you teach about mental illness, right, and mentalism, you say a person with a mental illness, not somebody who's mentally ill, because who they are is more than just a mental illness, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe it's the same idea, what you just kind of highlighted.
Yes. Yeah. And I know a lot of people that feel the same way of they don't want to identify with their trauma. I mean, some people do like the, the language of survivor, or, but some people, it feels too much like taking it on as an identity. Be uncomfortable. It's like, no, that's not my identity. It's just an experience that I had.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. I'm having like a lot of this is just kind of something that sparked in my mind, but have you been following the news case about there's that really horrible case right now about the teenage boy that was killed by kind of neglect and abuse in his home, and they found that it was kind of a mother and his older sibling that were perpetrating it. It was there was no
Where was
father.
this?
So I
No.
can't remember where it was, but the mom's name is Shauna Vander Ark or something like that. And I've been following it and trying to kind of wrap my mind around it because I mean, you know, it was just a really horrible, tragic case with kind of criminal, you know, child abuse and neglect. But yeah, the part that stood out to me was that it was this boy's older brother and his mom together that were kind of perpetrating the abuse and the
I'm
neglect.
going to look that up.
Yeah, it's I had never read a case quite like that before where I was like, hey, how does this happen? You know, how does and in that case, it's kind of it seems that, you know, there's already like an abusive parent and then one of the siblings becomes almost like allied with the parent, you know, against kind of the target within
That's
the
the collusion that I was referring
home.
to, you know. But it's so interesting that you're saying about this case as you're talking about the media. I'm thinking about TV and film, right? And I mean, how many movies have been made about parent-child abuse? And I remember one. It was with Ricky Schroeder. I don't know if you ever saw it, about sibling abuse. And it was
I don't
based on
think
a true
so.
case, I think, that he killed his sibling. But this was like probably in 1980 something, 1990 something that this was made.
No, I've seen very, very few representations of it anywhere in film. So what do you find working with people that have experienced, you know, sibling abuse or were the targets of sibling abuse? What do you find that manifests as in adulthood and what leads them to therapy? Do people come to therapy aware of like I, you know, experienced sibling abuse, or is it more something that gets uncovered later on that there wasn't conscious awareness of?
Great question. So this is, I say I wanted to put this on the map and write and build awareness. But I mean, if there are clinicians listening, I think it's incumbent on us to be able to ask the questions that will help uncover this. So you're raising an important piece where does the adult who comes to therapy even know that what they experienced was abusive, right? Most of the time, not. And I would say that they may be presenting that their relationship in adulthood with their sibling is strained and very kind of uncomfortable. And they won't use the word abusive, but they're describing abusive behavior. So, I feel like that's my kind of social responsibility to let them know that that is not normative, that is not okay, because I don't think that anybody has ever said this to them in their lifetime. So what happens is that their perception of reality gets distorted because it's never been validated, and in fact, the behavior, right, either explicitly or implicitly, of the sibling has been validated by a parent or a caregiver. And so, right, what has happened to me, must be my fault. There's something wrong with me. So we're really dealing with self-esteem issues, and we're dealing with some perception issues that, I don't trust my own judgment about things, but also certainly how it manifests is trust generally in people, right? So when I did my study, I was looking specifically, well, what is really trust about? Trust is about being able to depend on somebody, right? And a lot of people in our culture, abused or not, somehow feel that dependence is a weakness. And I always say you got to depend in order to become independent, right? And there's healthy dependence. We all need people. We all need connection. So, this needing to do everything for themselves, the idea that asking for help is a weakness, taking on everything and feeling disappointed in people a lot of the times because you can't trust that you can ask for what you need. So it gets played out, this idea of trust. I mean, I really have had to kind of develop my conceptual breadth of what trust or distrust looks like for people. But I think I listened to one of your episodes about people-pleasing behavior. And pleasing behavior is also certain, certainly something that adults contend with who have survived this because they want to avoid conflict at any cost. So if I can anticipate the needs of other people, then, I can avoid conflict because people are generally very uncomfortable with their own anger and the anger of other people. And so, and because there hasn't been a lot of ability or experience to regulate one's emotions and to be soothed. I also say we have to be soothed in order to self-soothe. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times people who have been abused by a sibling have a hard time coming back to baseline. So I always say to people, you know, are you somebody who, when you're upset, when you're depressed, when you're angry, how long does it take you to get back to kind of stability? Some people, you know, right, can do it in a minute. You have an argument with a partner, and maybe the partner is giving you the silent treatment for a day, you know, and you've bounced back within 2 minutes. Or vice versa. So do you take a couple of hours? Do you take a day? Do you take a couple of weeks? How long does it take you? So people who've been abused generally take a while to kind of come back to baseline. So you can see how potentially this plays out in not only romantic relationships, but friendships, right? And if we go back to what I was saying earlier, that siblings help to shape communication, conflict resolution, negotiation, a sense of loyalty. I mean, you have been betrayed by your most important peer, right? So why is anybody else going to be either invested in you, going to value you, where you can kind of share your, like I said, perspective or opinion or viewpoints without being challenged or told that you don't matter, either, again, explicitly or implicitly?
Yeah. As you're saying that, I'm thinking about especially like the conflict piece, because the sibling relationships really are, it's almost like the relationship where you get the most practice for conflict resolution, right? Because you're just naturally going to, you know, be in conflict with each other, like living in the same house and, you know, and so in like those healthy sibling relationships, you get all of these opportunities to experience like, oh, we get mad at each other, you know, we're irritated with each other, we're annoyed with each other, but then we come back together and we still love each other and we figure it out and we still have a good time together. And so when it's healthy, it's this really like beautiful opportunity almost to experience the kind of rupture and repair, you know, cycle that creates secure attachment. Yeah. And when it's not, I can see how devastating that would be to
years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if we think about attachment styles, right? Secure, avoidant, ambivalent, insecure, you know, somebody who's had this experience is not going to develop secure attachment styles.
Right. Yeah. Are there other recommendations that you would have for clinicians that want to get better at identifying this and working with this and helping clients with this?
Well, I think first and foremost, if I can, this is an opportunity to promote my podcast.
Yeah.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. It's called What Would Dr. Myers Do? And it has lots of different topics, but I do have a dedicated series to sibling abuse where I break it down from what is this? What does it look like? What, as you said, what causes this? What are the symptoms? What are the signs? How can we detect it? What are the long-term repercussions? What are resilient aspects of it in terms of how can we protect children from this so that we can, prevent it, detect it early, and then address it when it is present. And then I have, stories from people who have lived through this experience, talking about what their experience is. But I want to, the goal to towards this is so that people who are in positions of helping know the questions to ask. That's first. I mean, once you uncover it and assess it, then you got to learn how to intervene. But if we can just simply start asking, what is the nature and quality of your relationship with your sibling, in the same way that we put emphasis and explore the history and the nature of the parent-child relationship? I mean, most of us have thought about the impact that our parents have had on us growing up and how we became who we became. But do we really give that same consideration and thought to the impact of our siblings on us? And if we don't do that, then can the professionals who are supposed to understand, you know, our behavior and our actions help us to explore what was that relationship like? How has that impacted us? And start to give it some weight, the weight that it deserves. That's the beginning. I mean, I could go on.
Totally. So the questions to ask, I mean, I imagine the questions to ask would start with even just asking people about their sibling relationships at all. Cause I think sometimes that's probably not part of what every therapist does while they're kind of screening and learning about a client's background. So asking like, how were your sibling relationships? And then I imagine if someone expresses, oh, they weren't great, or to actually keep investigating and to not just go, oh, okay, sibling rivalry, but to be, well, how was it not great? And what was that dynamic like? And kind of just keep digging. Right?
And really break it down, because again, people don't know how to talk about it necessarily, you know, oh, it was nice. Oh yeah, we played together all the time. How did you play? How did you argue when you got into a disagreement? What would happen? Mm-hmm. How did you enjoy spending time together? And asking this too of parents, if you're seeing children. I mean, this is right. We're talking about if we're assuming we're working with the adult. But if you're working with a child, you should be asking the parent, who do they enjoy spending time with? How do they enjoy spending time? If you see that they're still talking about the one child over and over and over, I mean, we learn to read between the lines. What's not being said, right? What's the latent content? So there's a lot of exploration to be done, and looking at the history of what were your parents' relationship like with their sibling, because this stuff does become intergenerational. And when we don't have the models for healthy relationships, we don't know how to pass that on or create that between and amongst our children, right?
Yeah. Yep, totally. Yeah. Another thing that I was thinking about, especially when you were talking earlier about the power and control dynamics of, like, you know, with a normal sibling relationship, there's more of like a reciprocity for, you know, who's kind of on top in the different arguments. But that with these abusive dynamics, there's, you know, one person holding the power. You know, it really is similar in a lot of ways to, I mean, it is actually a form of domestic violence, right? It's, you know, it's violence that's happening within the home. And that's another area of interest for me, is like intimate partner violence, domestic violence. And when you're assessing for that, the main thing you have to assess for is power and control, because people don't always know how to assess power dynamics, right? And so it's actually a mistake that happens with intimate partner violence too, is people will hear about, you know, these dynamics, and they'll kind of assume that it's a reciprocal thing of like, oh, it's like there's mutual violence, or there's mutual dysfunction, or you're both toxic, or, you know, different things like that. And it's like, yeah, no, but you have to assess who has the power first. And if, I mean, there are relationships where there's not a power differential and it's just two people being dysfunctional, but with intimate partner violence, you know, you're going to find someone that is, you know, holding the power and then using that power, you know, to hurt someone else. So that was another connection I drew.
Mm-hmm. That's a good connection. I think there are studies that have found that those who have abused their sibling are also likely to be in intimate partner violent relationships, as well as the target is going to be the target of an intimate partner violent relationships. Although also they're really good at keeping partners at a distance. So oftentimes those who have survived the situation, right? And I guess I'm just referencing to the person in adulthood, will find people who are emotionally or physically unavailable. So, you know, getting into long distance relationships, that's safe, right?
Right.
Nobody wants to be with somebody who is an emotionally unavailable. What we tend to repeat what we know. And I always say it's kind of really curious, the human condition, in that we're uncomfortable, but it's comfortable because it's familiar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's these distancing strategies that are going to happen because you've learned to associate intimacy, you know, with like violence
pain.
And danger. And
what did you say? I'm sorry, I cut you off.
I said violence. Violence, danger, pain. Yeah.
Or pain, just emotional pain. Forget that, you know, maybe there's not even violence present, but it's still emotional pain.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm.
Trying to get something you need from someone who's incapable of giving it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it must be, I'm thinking about, just the emotional impact of the sibling abuse too, because it's really a big loss. Like, I'm sure there's grief involved too, because I mean, you know, there's the kind of acute damage of abuse, but then there's also the fact that you've missed out on, you know, this sibling relationship, right? And particularly for like a younger sibling who was mistreated by an older sibling, you know, so many people expect an older sibling to be protective, right? Like protective and loving and guiding. And so to miss out on that must be really painful too.
You hit it on the head, right? It's mourning a loss. And sometimes it's like divorce, you know, sometimes mourning people who are alive is harder than mourning people who are no longer with us. Because you kind of know they're out there. And you also can see what other people have in their family dynamics.
Yeah.
But you can create that for yourself, right? That's why they do say that, you know, your friends can be your family. You don't choose your biological family, but you can choose your What's the other term for that? Like your
A
developed
chosen
family,
family, or
chosen family.
yeah.
Thank you. Your chosen family. And I also like, I'm a big proponent of emotional cutoffs if the behavior continues into adulthood and it's not reparative. So, as children, you don't feel like you have any power. You don't, right? One of the reasons that we call children part of populations who are at risk or vulnerable part of the vulnerable population is because they don't have a voice. But as an adult, you have a voice and you have a choice, and you can take back that power and control, and not as a retaliatory measure, but as self-preservation.
Are there situations that you've seen where there is that repair, where the sibling that was abusive is able to like take accountability and you're able to maybe like rebuild a relationship in adulthood?
Yes, I have seen that. It takes two conditions, I think. One is that, yes, the behavior does not still continuing. And two, when that aggressive sibling is able to acknowledge what occurred, might not understand it themselves and why they did that, but feel very apologetic or shameful and want to make it right. So, yeah, there are situations like that. There's a lot of situations where there aren't.
And the thing that I've come across a lot in my practice that's so hard is that, so like if the family and if the wider family system don't have aren't supportive of the person that was targeted and abused, then that person ends up being the one that's alienated from the family, right? Because like, let's say, I've had a lot of clients where they don't want to be around the person that abused them in childhood, who's never taken accountability, who they don't feel safe around, whether it was a sibling or sexual abuse or some other kind of abuse. But the family is more concerned with sweeping everything under the rug, making everything look okay, keeping the appearances. And so then the client that was abused ends up being the one that doesn't go to family gatherings, that isn't invited to things, that has, alienated relationships with family members, because they're not willing to, pretend nothing happened and put themselves in those positions.
Yes, that is common, right? And so the relationships become strained with the other family members, one, because they don't feel supportive, or two, they don't want to put that family member in a compromising position themselves. They feel bad, but they don't want to continue to expose themselves to further harm. Plus, they may also feel resentful that this person gets to have a relationship with the parent, and again, they're still unprotected in that sense, right? So it brings up a lot of hardship, a lot of difficult feelings.
Yes, it's really, really difficult. For anyone listening to this podcast that's relating, and has had this experience, do you have any suggestions for them in terms of how they can find a therapist that can, work with them on this, or any other kind of resources that are, healing or helpful for people on this journey?
I appreciate that question. I think that resources are few and far between, but I do want to provide some hope. First of all, there are a lot. I know social media is very impactful these days. There are Facebook groups for survivors of sibling abuse, for members of narcissistic siblings and narcissistic family members. So I think that sometimes having a forum with like-minded people who have experienced these things, because I think like a support group would be great. I don't know, how many of them exist and which states. I am putting together a support slash psychodynamic group that will be done virtually for survivors of sibling abuse. But there is an organization that I'm on the advisory board now called SARA, SAARA. They're connected with the University of New Hampshire, and SARA stands for Sibling Abuse Advocacy and No, sorry. Sibling Abuse and Aggression Research and Advocacy. So if you look up SAARA, they have a whole list of resources. They write newsletters. They have posts on Psychology Today. I think, it's really important for people to know that this experience is real. What you've experienced is valid. No one can tell you what it was or what it wasn't. I think therapy is really important. I don't think you need to have a therapist who has had this personal experience themselves. I think therapists are really well trained to understand and want to understand your lived experience from you. So I highly recommend therapy. I can speak about that as a professional and personally. It really helped me. What else? I'm hoping that my podcast will help provide some insight, normalization of what you are experiencing, and pathways to healing.
Yep. And I'll include your links for your podcast and your website and stuff in the description. So if people want to check it out or reach out to you, they can do that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, before we wrap up, is there anything else that we haven't covered yet that you want to mention? Or do you feel like we were pretty thorough here?
I think we were pretty thorough. I think that you did a really good job of tuning into the key issues and the key points, you know, that are important. And I would like to encourage, if anybody has questions, they can DM me or email me. I'm drmyerspod@gmail.com. I have a Facebook page, Instagram page, and TikTok. So please, questions are welcome. And I'd love to have an episode on my own podcast where I can respond to people's questions directly. So thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on. I know I've been actually wanting to address this, so I was really excited when you reached out. So
awesome.
It's going to resonate for a lot of people. Thank you so much. Let me find the, here we go.